Welcome to another episode of Startup Health Now, the weekly show celebrating the healthcare transformers and change makers that are reimagining healthcare. My name is Stephen Krein.
And I'm Unity Stokes.
And on today's episode, we're sitting down with Jonathan Javitt, a physician, an entrepreneur, an investor, a policy advisor, and a dad currently living in Israel. And we're going to talk about the state of digital healthcare and the potential for changing the healthcare landscape over the next decade. This is going to be a great episode.
Stick around.
It is the duty of leaders to lead, of the creative to create, of the daring to do. The free world expects leadership of us. Its fate and our fate depends upon our leadership. We are industrious, inventive, restless, with the fires that burn within us. Well, I say that nothing is easy, and the best things are the hardest. And all our troubles, all our immense difficulties, now and in the future, can I say, be solved if we have the will, courage. The future is to those who take it.
Welcome back to Startup Health Now. I'm excited about today's guest, Jonathan Javitt. What an incredible background, a physician, a policy advisor, an entrepreneur, an investor in healthcare in Israel, here in the U.S. You're currently living in Israel. I'm excited to have you here. We're really excited to spend time together.
Thank you.
So tell us more about you. How did you get into healthcare to begin with?
Well, getting into healthcare was sort of a no-brainer. I'm a third-generation physician. My father's favorite uncle graduated from medical school in Prague in 1939 and hightailed it out of town just in time. My father went to medical school in the South in the 1950s and is still in his laboratory every morning at the age of 85. So deciding to be a doctor was easy. The challenge was figuring out what kind of doctor I was going to be. And I had two heroes in medical school. One of them was a brilliant eye surgeon who, as it happened, had figured out how to save sight in newborns with a rare cancer of the eye. Truly the kind of hero everybody wants to have in medical school.
Yeah.
And the other was a man who had worked on tropical illnesses just about everywhere on the planet. Started out when President Roosevelt sent him down to the Panama Canal Zone to work on malaria. And the challenge for me as a medical student was figuring out, well, how do I find a career that lets me, do the things that both of these guys excited me over? And I had the good fortune to come across another role model, a man named Alfred Sommer, who ultimately became the dean of the Hopkins School of Public Health and proved that 2 cents worth of vitamin A every day not only prevents blindness in children in the developing world, but also reduces mortality by a third. And spent the next years after I finished my training working with Al on different areas of what we at the time called epidemiology and ophthalmology. But I kept asking, well, is this good or bad for the economy? The first research study I ever did was in India, where we interviewed people who had just benefited from mass cataract surgery programs, where you'd set up a camp and for $5 you could take out a cataract and make a blind person see again.
Wow.
I wasn't interviewing them about their eyesight as much as, well, what happened in their lives? And it turned out that the average person who benefited from that $5 investment generated a 1,500% return on the investment in the first year. It ultimately, when it got published and developed and turned into a couple of chapters and things, induced the World Bank to invest $2 billion in standing up cataract surgery hospitals around India and that part of the world.
So that shaped your view, your focus on being an eye surgeon?
It shaped my focus on being an eye surgeon, but more importantly, it shaped my focus on looking for ways to, trim tab. The trim tab is the little thing on the back of the rudder of a huge ship where, it takes an incredible amount of mechanical force to turn the ship. It takes much less mechanical force to turn the trim tab, and then the trim tab shifts the rudder and the whole ship turns.
Right.
So, what I learned from the experience is if you can find ways to develop technologies that save lives and save money at the same time, you can accomplish almost anything in healthcare.
So you've done so many additional things in addition to be a doctor. How did you first become an entrepreneur?
Kind of by accident. I had discovered computers early on in medical school. I was, you know, probably one of two people in the medical school class who owned an Apple II and played with it. And as an intern, rather than write the same admission note longhand over and over again, I wrote a little program on the computer that would, you know, spit out these beautiful four-page notes. So doctors who were in the hospital would come to me and say, well, gee, could you help me bring a computer into my office? So, you know, while my colleagues were out moonlighting, you know, doing extra medical work in the evenings, I was moonlighting computerizing people's offices.
So you were one of the first digital doctors.
I'd certainly say that I was one of the first doctors I know to play with computers and electronic medical records.
That's great.
And that, by the way, led you to, you were the, an advisor for three presidents on technology and its role in healthcare, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Which presidents? And it goes, well, under an interesting
President
story
Reagan
about 2001.
And President Bush, I had the chance to be an expert consultant to Medicare. And we did some of the first work showing that the Medicare database was an incredibly powerful tool for understanding how healthcare is delivered and how healthcare could be improved. And then Mrs. Clinton asked me to be on the healthcare reform task force at the beginning of the Clinton administration. Although when I suggested that digital health was a major key to making healthcare work in the U.S., it didn't go very far. But I had a similar chance.
Was that because it was just too early, do you think?
Well, the belief at the time was if we just spend enough money and give enough people access to medical care, that's all we need to do to solve the problem. And it took 10 years for people to realize that just throwing more money at the problem without throwing technology at the problem would increase the cost of healthcare, but not necessarily solve the problem.
Yeah, we often talk about the today we're sitting at this unique convergence of, you know, healthcare reform and the acceleration of cost in chronic disease and aging, but it's also that digital health technology data exists now to be able to do more than just throw the healthcare at the problem, but actually bring technology. And then living in this golden age of entrepreneurship, so you've got entrepreneurs now able to access capital and expertise and resources that they never were able to before. And so having done this advising for past presidents and for all of your kind of background in education, when you look today at, you know, what the market looks like, how confident are you that today is different than the last decade or the last two decades?
I'm utterly convinced of it. But it's important to recognize that when you say the you doing advising for presidents, I think in the Bush administration, we really had a unique confluence of people. And it's particularly exciting to be talking about that here in San Francisco. You know, purely through happenstance, the people that President Bush appointed to the President's Information Technology Advisory Council sort of weren't the old academic fuddy-duddies who had typically been appointed to that sort of role. In fact, Mark Benioff was the overall chairman before Salesforce went public. And in terms of the people I had on my health committee, I had, you know, Peter Neupert, who went on to found Microsoft Health and is now here, you know, working with Health Evolution Partners. You know, Peter and I were instrumental in once the blueprint for the Office of the National Coordinator of Health IT was done and President Bush signed the policy, you know, we had the chance to recruit David Brailer, who's, you know, sits right here in San Francisco, to be the first national coordinator for health IT. So there was just this magical you know, conglomeration of people, some of whom were Republicans, some of whom were Democrats, all of whom were committed to healthcare transformation, who, you know, came together under that Bush administration umbrella and had a chance to do something at a magical moment in time.
So they laid a lot of the foundation for what's been able to happen now.
We wrote the blueprint, and yep. President Bush signed the blueprint, and, you know, everything that's happened since, there's been a lot of detail filled in, and there's been incredible contribution by, you know, David's now had four successors in the role of national coordinator. You know, but all of this happened because, you know, the first president of the United States with an MBA, namely George W. Bush, remember, not a lawyer,
right.
First president of the United States with an MBA saw that if you really want to make healthcare work, you need to do something, you know, about the fundamental wiring of the system.
You know, one of the things that I'm always curious to learn about is on the regulatory side of things. And I know you spent some time around with the FDA, and one of the big questions that comes up from entrepreneurs is, can the pace of regulatory change keep pace with what's happening with innovation? What are your thoughts on that?
I think the FDA today is more responsive to the innovation issues raised by digital health than at any time in the agency's history. And, you know, on one hand, no agency, no regulatory agency is ever going to meet the demands of innovators and entrepreneurs. It's impossible.
Right.
At the same time, it's important to regulate, to recognize that it's only 30 years now since, it's more like 40 years, since a drug called thalidomide was the rage in Europe. Mm-hmm. It was this, you know, magic medicine that was help people with sleep and help pregnant women with nausea, and led to an entire generation of humans without arms and legs, except in the United States, where the FDA said, well, let's wait just a minute, because we've never heard of a drug that has no side effects. Let's try to understand what the side effects might be. So, and that's far from the first time that the FDA has kept something from taking hold in the United States that was widely believed to be magic elsewhere. So at some level, the American people have benefited from a risk-based regulatory system. That said, I think the FDA has taken some amazingly forward-thinking steps in the last 2 years, maybe more forward-thinking than even I ever imagined they could. Their recent policy documents on digital health have been more clear and more open, and the process for generating those documents, than I've ever seen the FDA do. Mm-hmm. They've really drawn some very clear, bright lines and said, give me 1 second.
Yeah, yeah.
Listen, there's this line here between things that people are going to use to help with their health and things that people are going to do to regulate medical devices.
Right.
And we have to distinguish them. So if you're going to use an iWatch to track your pulse and improve your cardiac performance, that's great. That's a consumer product. And we, the FDA, would like to know if it's harming anybody. So please keep an eye out. But we don't need to give you permission to do that. On the other hand, if you're going to use an iWatch to control an insulin pump or a pacemaker or something else that could kill you, we're going to view that the same way we view any other control mechanism for a pacemaker or an insulin pump. And we're going to apply the same degree of scrutiny because our job is to keep the public safe.
So you have a unique context for everything that's happening today in the historical context that of the importance that it plays in innovation. And it can't just be get out of the way or have government get out of the way and let entrepreneurs do what they do. There's a balance. How can today's entrepreneurs, A, not get too scared off by the regulatory environment here in the U.S. and other places, and as a result, stifle what really needs to happen in this sector by embracing and testing and experimenting with what might work and what might not work, but yet need to figure it out?
Well, I think it starts out by embracing the regulatory environment and embracing the underlying need for the regulatory environment, which is to safeguard the public. You know, that said, going into the healthcare entrepreneurial world, you know, is not the same as going into consumer electronics. People's lives are at stake. And the entrepreneur can't say, well, government ought to just get out of the way because, you know, we know best and the market's going to decide. In general, when it comes to highly complex market decisions that are related to, you know, instruments that can harm people, the public really isn't equipped to decide. There is some scientific overview that's needed. So probably the most important thing to do is in fact what you're doing is, you know, as part of a healthcare startup academy, make people smart about how to approach the regulatory system. People come to me with, you know, startup medical devices all the time, and it's incredibly unusual. In fact, I'm not sure I can remember the last time that I couldn't show them a regulatory path that'll get that device to market.
That's so the, right there, I'm going to point stop because it's a, I want to dig deeper right there. Path. How critical is it to do that early before you figured out your product? And I want to, you know, talk about when they come to you. Are they coming to you with the idea phase? Are they coming to you after they've already built the prototype? When's the optimal time to start to think about that path?
Well, the optimal time is already, you know, before you spend the first dollar on the prototype, because there's so much that you can do to inform how to spend that first dollar. But, you know, at any point in the path, before you just go ahead and do it and get a warning letter from the FDA, it makes sense to get on board the train. I mean, there are people who just go and build something and start selling it, and the next thing they know, somebody shows up with a badge and says, well, I'm from the FDA, and it looks to us like the thing you're selling is a medical device, but it also looks to us like you're selling an uncleared medical device, so we'd like you to withdraw it from the market. Well, that's, you know, the worst possible thing you could do with shareholders' equity.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes it's not so black and white if it's a medical device or not, right? I think digital health and devices and sensors and so many things play a little bit different of a role. So digital health sometimes might not be digital health. Certain pieces of software and others kind of blend where the device starts and stops, and some of it might be just ignorance or not understanding it. But how do you distinguish where or what the entrepreneur should be asking about how to determine if the FDA or the FDA path and how it might play out for them?
It's hard to answer that question on one foot. Or even, you know, in one interview, there's 20 to 30 pages of guidance that just came out from FDA in the last year that really, I think, does a brilliant job of giving people context for making those decisions. Mm-hmm. The decision's going to be different for every single device. But, you know, again, there is that bright line. Is this something that's being used as a consumer product in order to help you quantify yourself, quantify your health, or is this something that if it malfunctions could actually hurt you? And yeah, the closer you are to one end of the spectrum versus the other, the closer you are to being completely unregulated versus being closely regulated.
Interesting. If we could shift gears just for a second, I'd love to talk for a moment about the global view of digital health. We're very inspired by all the innovation we're seeing around the world. We're sitting here in San Francisco. Our headquarters is in New York. You're living now in Israel. Love to hear what you're seeing in Israel in terms of digital health and the entrepreneurship that you're seeing on a day-to-day basis there.
I think the startup environment in Israel and much of the you know, non-U.S. world is breathtaking. And part of it is there's less infrastructure outside of the United States than there is here. You know, if you're ill in the United States, there are, you know, five different hospital beds that would, you know, gladly compete for your business.
Right.
Israel's a country that has perhaps a 10% shortage of available hospital beds, a waiting time to get into a hospital bed, and you know, move a little bit northeast or south of Israel, and that shortage of available healthcare resources goes up by orders of magnitude. So, just as you know, in the United States, it took a while for people to start pulling out their wire lines and go exclusively cellular for their day-to-day telephonic needs. I mean, you probably have friends today who don't have a home telephone, but that's only
yeah.
That's a new phenomenon for us. And yet there are entire countries in Africa that simply haven't laid down copper wire for telephone because they just went straight to cellular.
And we're seeing the same thing with banking, where places in Africa have more sophisticated banking infrastructure than here in the U.S. There's this leapfrog opportunity. So you're seeing the same thing
whole
in healthcare?
Huge part of the world where digital health is going to be the first real healthcare that some populations in some countries get access to.
You know, it draws directly on, you know, one of the other conditions that has emerged, this globalization. It's a global conversation. What we can learn from what's happening in India, what others can learn for what's happening, as you mentioned, first healthcare systems in place today. The conversation's global. The lessons learned, what we can take away from what's working in different parts of the world and apply it, whether it's here in the U.S. or anywhere. What do you think the implications are for the patient and the families as it relates to that? Because some of it won't be regulated necessarily. Some of it won't be following the same traditional path where the large corporations or governments control a lot of the flow of that. How does that work?
Well, I think, you know, China's a great example, and I'm in China a couple of times a year. You're watching an entire country go from an environment where the average person had almost no access to anything resembling modern healthcare to a country where people are increasingly expecting that their government will deliver modern healthcare, but they can't build hospitals quickly enough. And unless we find a way to extend the hospital into somebody's home and to, you know, give them that face-to-face interaction with the healthcare system immediately and potentially virtually, there's really no hope of catching up in time.
Right. But it's not unless we do. It's clearly going to happen.
Yes.
How long is it going to take to happen? How long do you think this transformation visible impact is going to take?
I think it's going to take much less time than we think.
You do?
Yeah.
How long is that?
I think that...
It seems like it's happening right now.
So I belong to an organization called the Wireless Life Sciences Alliance. And I remember 5 years ago, Rob McCray, who has founded and led that organization, you know, stood up and said, well, how long do you think it will be before the FDA clears the first wireless medical device? Actually asked that question in a room full of 200 people 5 years ago. And somebody handed me a microphone, and I said, well, the real question to ask is how long is it going to be before the FDA will refuse to clear a medical device that's not cloud connected?
Right. That's great. So what are you most excited about today in terms of health innovation, digital health? I'd be curious from a physician's perspective and also a entrepreneur and investor's perspective, what's most exciting to you?
The thing that has me most excited is that, you know, young people who, you know, have no interest in, you know, doing what they have to do to go to medical school are suddenly interested in becoming part of the solution, that all of a sudden there's capital available for this solution, that people are recognizing that this is one of the great challenges of the 21st century, and they want to get on board. And, you know, clearly, you know, as a physician, I wholeheartedly support physicians in being part of this. But as an entrepreneur, the fact that, you know, people who are not physicians are never going to be physicians, but see, you know, one little piece of the problem and say, well, I can make that work better, are getting involved in doing this instead of, you know, building another cell phone or a 3D printer or whatever else. The fact that, you know, healthcare has captured their imagination is incredibly exciting.
So with all the different roles you've played and continue to play, which role do you enjoy the most and do you feel fits your own unique ability as investor, as entrepreneur, as physician? You know, which of them that most excites you?
Well, you know, physician is the role that I bring to everything I do. I remember, you know, 14 years ago, my son, who just graduated from Columbia, came to me very concerned and said, Dad, aren't you a doctor anymore? Because he'd realized that, you know, I wasn't going to the hospital anymore. And I said to him, well, of course I'm a doctor. It's just that the things that I'm involved in let me help, more people in a day than I could ever help in a year, seeing them one at a time. So, that's the perspective, that I bring. Just as, when you meet people who have, taken religious vows but then left their order, they still bring that perspective to everything else they go on to do in life, even if they're no longer wearing brown robes.
So, advice to entrepreneurs just getting started today. What are some wisdom that you would share with them?
Well, I think the most important thing is to recognize that there's no monopoly on good ideas. And if you can avoid reinventing the wheel by really researching what others have done and finding a place to come together with other entrepreneurs to hone the idea, to refine the idea, before you go out and spend your graduate school savings on building something that may have already been built before, that's a great place to start.
So finding the unique value proposition before you get started.
Well, not only the unique value proposition, but finding the community of people who can help you stay on track, who can help you recognize what's unique about your idea and what the market proposition is for your idea, rather than digging into a corner and deciding that it's all going to come out of your own head.
Do you think you're, with what you've done in the past, and as you look at the next 5 years, 10 years for yourself, will you invest in more companies, start another company, join? What are you thinking about as it relates to kind of how you can play an active role in the transformation, not only from where you sit in Israel, but obviously globally?
I have a hard enough time knowing what I'm going to do tomorrow, much less what I'm going to do 10 years from now. My guiding principles are, how can I use the time that I have in order to harness technology, in order to save lives, and do it in a way that saves money, only because I've learned the hard way that if the economics aren't there, it doesn't matter how good the life-saving part is. And whether I do that as a mentor, as an investor, the reason, quite frankly, the reason I got involved in founding Telcare is because people were saying that you couldn't do a wireless medical device, that there wasn't a regulatory path for it, that the cellular communication part was too hard to work out. People didn't see it as part of the future. So, usually when you tell me that something's impossible, that's when I get irritated enough to try to prove that it is possible.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a very fascinating conversation, and love that you're doing what you're doing. It's obviously made a huge impact on getting us to where we are today in terms of the digital health revolution.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. And thanks for listening to another episode of Startup Health Now. You can find this and all Startup Health Now episodes at startuphealth.com/now. Thank you for joining us. And Jonathan, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.